I'm Lori Mack, sitting in for Faith Middleton on assignment. This show is about the richness of life. Thanks for listening in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including the East End of Long Island. We've heard about major corporations being hacked, companies like Sony, Target, Home Depot, and Anthem, potentially affecting millions of consumers. But my guest will tell you security breaches like these just barely scratch the surface when it comes to the internet's dark side. My guest is Mark Goodman. He spent his career in law enforcement and technology, worked with organizations such as the Los Angeles Police Department, the FBI, and the Secret Service. He's also worked as a senior advisor to Interpol. He's an expert on cyber risk, intelligence, and counterterrorism, and has written this fascinating book about the flip side of technology and how technological advances can be turned against us. The name of the book is Future Crimes: Everything is Connected, Everyone is Vulnerable, and What We Can Do About It. Mark Goodman, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's my pleasure to be here.
In the beginning of the book, you tell this shocking story about Matt Honan, who is now bureau chief for BuzzFeed in San Francisco. But at the time of the story, he was a senior staff writer for Wired, which is a magazine all about technology. Could you tell the story of how Matt Honan was hacked?
Yeah, so Matt Honan, as you said, worked for, you know, one of the great technology magazines of the world. He was about as cyber savvy as anybody else could be. And one day he was sitting at home playing with his infant daughter on his lap and was expecting a conference call. And as he was playing with his daughter, he glanced over at his iPhone over on the desk and he saw that it rebooted and kind of turned off. He thought that was weird. He went back to turn it on. And when he did, rather than seeing his own iPhone screen, what he saw was the big white Apple logo, and it said, you know, please set up your phone. And he's like, what do you mean set up my phone? My phone was already set up. So then he went to his iPad, and he noticed that it was rebooting. And then he went to his laptop computer, and he saw that it was rebooting. And as it turns out, a hacker halfway around the world got into Matt's accounts and was able to basically use the remote wipe feature to take them out. And this hacker was able to erase all of Matt's digital life. He lost pictures of his infant daughter from the time she was born until the age of two. All of those photos that he stored in the cloud were deleted. He had photographs of his relatives who had long since passed away, photographs that could never be replaced. He had digitized. He had 8 years of Gmail, and it was all erased. And so even though Matt was super technologically savvy, somebody was able to get access to his online accounts, figure out his password, and take over his digital life.
If that can happen to a guy whose career is based on writing about technology, how much more vulnerable are the rest of us?
Well, the fact of the matter is that we all depend on technology, whether or not we realize it. But when you put things into a computer system, particularly when that computer system is connected to the internet, then people that can get access to that anywhere in the world are doing so with greater frequency. You know, the challenge that Matt had and what was fascinating about his own hack attack was that after he became the victim of that crime, he wrote a very lengthy feature article in Wired magazine where he said, it's time to kill the password. And if you think about it, that's actually one of the fundamental flaws in the system, because these passwords are so difficult to manage. Most people use the same password on multiple sites. They're easily guessed. So they're kind of the Achilles heel for all of this. So Matt advocated to kill the password, and I couldn't agree with him more, and replace them with more robust forms of security. But broadly, we are not there yet. So all of our digital information is at risk.
And as a side note, this person that hacked him did that for his Twitter handle?
Yeah, believe it or not, Matt created a new Twitter account because he was locked out of his Twitter account so he could engage with the person who had taken over his actual account. And he started tweeting at that person, who came forward and admitted that the only reason why he hacked Matt's life was because he wanted his Twitter handle. @MAT. It was a short Twitter handle. The guy wanted it for himself, and that's why he took over his digital life. So he said freely, hey, I have no animosity towards you. I just wanted this, so I took it.
Incredible. In the introduction, I mentioned security breaches at companies like Sony and Anthem. You also talk about the cost of data breaches and how the extent of those losses go well beyond the direct consumer theft amounts.
One of the challenges that we have is that all of our information obviously is being digitized. And what's fascinating about this is that the cost of keeping this information has dropped precipitously. So all of that ability to store information and the price drop on it means that more and more businesses are keeping all of the data that they can possibly want and produce. And they're deriving new insights into their customers through what's called big data analytics. And so there's this drive to keep all of our information online. But the downside of that is the more data that you keep, the more that organized crime can go out there and take. Studies by something called the Ponemon Institute has shown that the average cost per each record stolen is about $210, because there are the direct costs of having a company hacked and the indirect costs. So if you are Target and you're hacked, the first thing that you need to do is beef up your security team. You need to call in outside experts. You need to remediate the systems that have been hacked. You need to do a forensic examination so you can figure out what happened. You'll need to buy new equipment. You need to send new credit cards to your customers at the cost of $5 or $10 each for processing. You need to bring in outside PR experts to handle the incident. You'll need to bring in both your internal general counsel and hired outside law firms to manage it. Target, of course, was sued numerous times by consumers. Then Wall Street punished the company because their share value went down. Then come the shareholder lawsuits. So when you add up all of those aggregate costs, then you really see it, $210 a pop. It adds up. Target had over 100 million consumer records breached. So, you know, $110 times 100 million records is a phenomenal amount of money for these companies.
Mark, you mentioned big data. We hear a lot about big data and data brokers. What is or what are big data, and how are data brokers related?
Yeah, it's a great question. So, you know, we hear the term big data all the time, and it goes back to what we were discussing just a few moments ago, which is that now, through computer technology, the price of computer storage is basically dropping towards zero. So we can keep as much data as we like at relatively low cost, particularly now in the cloud, in third-party data centers. A lot of this data is being produced today, not just by your credit report and your finances, but your online activities. So every time you visit a website and they put 1 or 10 or 20 cookies on your website, every time you hit an I like something or the Facebook like button on a social media site, every time you search for something on the internet, all of that information is being correlated and tied back to you. So if you think about, for example, Facebook's business model, Facebook has 1.5 billion users, but the people that use the service are not the customer of Facebook. They're actually the product of Facebook. They are the thing that Facebook sells to its real customers, which are advertisers. So Facebook has created a world where they get people to post all their photographs, click on the things they like, lay out their entire social network, their family history, what school that they went to, and then Facebook slices and dices that data and sells it to advertisers. So if there's an advertising company out there that wants to sell to single moms in the inner city, boom. Beyond Facebook, there are even a whole band of other companies which are completely unregulated that are aggregating all of these clicks. And there have been some real horror stories about how this data has been used and abused by these third parties.
You had a story about a father who made some discoveries in regards to coupons that were being sent to his 15-year-old daughter. Is that an example of how this data has been abused?
Yeah, so a dad got a letter addressed to his 14 or 15-year-old daughter, and it was advertisements for baby products and diapers, and the dad was irate that his, you know, daughter, who was only 14 or 15, was getting this stuff. He marched into Target to complain to the manager, and, you know, the store was a bit flummoxed, and, you know, the dad said, "Hey, are you trying to get my teenage daughter to engage in sexual activity? Stop sending this to our house." And then the dad found out a few weeks later that, in fact, his daughter daughter was pregnant, and Target, who had analyzed her purchase history, actually came up with what they called a pregnancy determination score, and based upon a reanalysis of baby shower purchases, they were able to determine which women at any age were most likely to be pregnant. So Target figured out that this man's daughter was pregnant before the dad did. In the other case, a office supply company sent a catalog to a father whose daughter was killed in a car accident, and on the label from the office supply company it said, you know, to Mr. Jones, I'm making the name up, but to Mr. Jones, and underneath it said daughter killed in car accident, and then it had his address. Obviously it was a typo, but the fact that the office supply company had this information on him was quite a revelation and certainly disturbing, and perhaps one of the even more disturbing examples that people don't quite understand are what all of these so-called free internet sites do with your data. So there is a dating website out there that's been around for a long time called OkCupid. And OkCupid is free for anybody who wants to use this dating website. Users go on there, they fill out their profiles, you know, they put their likes and dislikes, etc. And then beyond that, they ask you quite personal information about the number of sexual partners that you've had and even your drug use. And the people that use OkCupid, and there are hundreds of thousands, if not more, that use the service, fill out this information because the supposition is if you like smoking marijuana or using cocaine, then you might want to date somebody who had similar inclinations. But what they didn't realize was OkCupid was actually taking that information and selling it to third-party data brokers. So if you clicked on the website, yes, I like using cocaine and I use it 3 times a week, they were actually dropping a cookie on your website, taking that information and selling it to third-party data brokers who then would use it for employment screening, for health insurance, for life insurance. So you might go ahead and apply for a job down the road and be denied that job, and you would have no reason why. But the reason why is because one of these so-called free websites took the answers to your question and then sold it on to a third party to be used against you down the road.
My guest is Mark Goodman. He's an expert on cybercrime, intelligence, and counterterrorism, and he's written this book, Future Crimes. I'm Laurie Mack, sitting in for Faith Middleton. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll talk more about data collection and how it's used and abused. I'm Laurie Mack, sitting in for Faith Middleton. We've been talking with Mark Goodman. He's worked for the Los Angeles Police Department and other organizations such as Interpol, the United Nations, and the U.S. government. He's the author of the book Future Crimes. And we've been talking about third-party data brokers and the data they're collecting from us and how that information gets used and abused. Mark, we were talking about using sites like OkCupid. What if you live in a household where several people use the same computer? How can data brokers be sure it's really you?
Well, you have to be careful, actually. We've had lots of people who have gotten in trouble because of those types of things. For those of you who run Wi-Fi in your house, there are lots of cases where people had open Wi-Fi connections, and then criminals would use those either to commit financial fraud or download child pornography. And so the FBI comes knocking at your house because your open website, your Wi-Fi, was used to download child pornography. There was a famous case from Miami a couple of years ago where a very prestigious businessman had his home raided because they thought he was downloading child pornography, and it turns out his top story, you know, tall apartment building overlooked the harbor, and there was a man on the boat in the harbor who was using that guy's Wi-Fi port to download the child pornography, but it caused him a lot of trouble. So that's one example. But yes, when you are downloading things and you're giving your children access to your computer, you'll find that they'll be downloading so-called, you know, free movies on the internet, and all of that stolen, pirated content certainly can get you in trouble. And then the one thing is that these data brokers are actually quite good about fingerprinting individuals, so they can actually separate people based upon who's using the computer and do a decent job of deaggregating that to isolate you.
How do they do that?
So believe it or not, there's a very fascinating and emerging world of identification that's going on the internet. And so they are targeting you. You may think, well, why would I care if OkCupid knows if I use marijuana or cocaine? Because rather than using my true name, I've created up a fake screen name like John in Connecticut, 1234. So if they just see John in Connecticut, 1234, how would they ever know that it's me? And this gets to the meat and the heart of the privacy discussion. They know it's you, number one, because on your website there are other cookies that you've left behind where you actually bought something on Amazon or paid for something with your credit card, logged into your bank account, so your true identification is there. And in some websites, they can read that type of information. Plus, there are third-party brokers where they work to actually de-anonymize who John in Connecticut 1234 is and trace it back to your real name. The other thing is your computer has a unique code on it known as a MAC address. That is the network connection to the internet. So that unique number personally identifies you. You have what's known as an internet protocol address on your Wi-Fi spot. So let's say that you use Time Warner Cable or AT&T. That specific IP address assigned to you is known by those cable companies and can be found out easily by third parties. So that's another way you are de-anonymized. And believe it or not, there are new and fascinating ways to de-anonymize and identify people, which are known as behavioral metrics. That is not just identifying you based upon what you say in your social media profile, but by physical specific ways in the way you interact with your computer. So it turns out we all type slightly differently. You will type with different speed, you will type with different pressure, and those little minute differences that are entirely imperceptible to a human being can be measured on a keyboard. It's called keystroke dynamics. And now even those minute behavioral changes in how people type can identify them to advertisers.
This is Mark Goodman. He's worked for the Los Angeles Police Department and other organizations such as Interpol, the United Nations, and the United States government. He's the author of the book we're talking about today called Future Crimes. Can we go back for a second to big data? What about big data and governments and the NSA, National Security Agency's role in data collection? You say our current computing systems are too insecure to safely store the volumes of information gathered. How does this leave us vulnerable?
You started to ask about government intrusion into our world and privacy, and those were the type of revelations that came out after WikiLeaks and Mr. Snowden made his pronouncement and released the classified government documents that he did. Many people will be concerned about risk to their data from government. So we certainly have seen a lot of media stories about how the NSA may be tracking people around the world and even Americans. We've seen, you know, allegations of breaches of privacy and security by the U.S. government against the people. And that is certainly something that we should be giving serious consideration to. But the other point that I make, as we just discussed, there are also these very large companies that we turn over our data to on a daily basis without a blink. And we share it with, you know, large internet companies. And the point is that the data is being accessed not just by the government, not just by large corporations, but also by criminals, and even terrorists have access to this data. So the data is out there, and the fact of the matter is those that are more computer savvy, those that have the technical know-how, have the ability to act against the interests of the broader public. And that's something I wanted to draw attention to in my book.
You mentioned Edward Snowden. Based on your knowledge and experience, do you feel the Snowden revelations were harmful in any way to our intelligence community or citizens? And I'm not questioning the integrity of the information or whether he should have revealed it.
Right. Well, you know, there was clearly classified information that was released in contravention of U.S. law. And people, I'm asked quite frequently, you know, do you think Edward Snowden is a criminal? Well, as defined by our current law, yes, definitely. He was a criminal, but at some point, you know, some would argue Martin Luther King was classified as a criminal and broke rules to drive greater social change. So it's definitely a complex issue. In terms of whether or not specific people were harmed as a result of this, I know that the U.S. government has alleged that people were harmed and were put at risk, but all of this remains in the world of classified information. So it's hard to say definitively unless you have access to that classified information one way or the other.
In terms of government surveillance, the United States currently has no laws in place that would delete information gathered on people who are not a threat to national security. Is that correct?
Well, not exactly. What I would say is the way that most people understand the collection permissions vis-a-vis United States and its intelligence community is that they are allowed to collect some domestically and some overseas. So organizations like the FBI would be responsible for domestic surveillance against national security threats, criminal threats, terrorist threats, and those would be subjected to broadly the U.S. criminal justice system, the Department of Justice. You would have to go to court to obtain wiretaps and other such orders. Overseas, however, when you have organizations like the NSA and others, they're operating under national security law, and it is permissible under national security law for the NSA, for example, to tap telephones of Al-Qaeda and their affiliates in Afghanistan, Yemen, Pakistan, and things like that. The brouhaha that's come up most recently is specifically to what extent our national security organizations are listening to and paying attention to American citizens who would theoretically be covered under U.S. law, who are covered under U.S. law and entitled to due process before that collection is enabled.
Are there countries... I think I may have read something about Europe, but are there countries that have laws in place already that delete these information sweeps after a certain time period?
Yes, definitely. So the United States is unique from a data privacy perspective. Most countries, certainly Western European countries, view data privacy and privacy in general as a human right. Many other countries, certainly throughout Western Europe, Canada, Australia, they have national privacy commissioners, so cabinet-level officers who are responsible for thinking about and protecting the privacy of a nation's citizenry. We do not have that in the United States. We have no national privacy commissioner, and we allow tremendous flexibility for companies to keep data on anybody they want for as long as they want. In Europe, they have something called the EU directive, the European Union directive on data privacy, which limits how long a company can keep data on potential clients or how long they can store this information. So, for example, in the United States, if you visit a website, a company can put as many cookies on your hard drive as possible, and there's no way really to opt out. In the EU, if you are surfing on a website in London or Paris or Rome, and you visit a website, and let's say you go to Amazon.it, you have to opt in to allow Amazon to put cookies, tracking cookies, on your website, and it's illegal under EU law for them to do it without your permission. In the EU, they have to, Amazon and all other companies there, have to delete your information after anywhere from 6 to 24 months, depending on the country. So there's no keeping customer information or large data brokerages that store information for 20 years or 10 years. That would be illegal under EU law. They have to delete it. But under U.S. law, it's completely permissible.
And is that something you think the United States should be looking at?
I certainly, as a citizen, I would like to have that option to opt out. I would like to have a much more balanced control over my data and my information. You know, the data is being generated, right? I don't think at this point it's quite difficult to not generate the data because there are so many devices, not just the devices that we know about today, like our laptops and our work computers and our iPhones and our iPads and our Androids, but other types of devices are generating data too. Everything from our Fitbit fitness bands to our Xbox 360s to our cars with GPS tracking in it, all of these devices. You know, when you read a book, certain book companies, if you read it on a reader, they can tell what page you're on. So all of this data is being generated. So I don't know, frankly, how much we can do about the data generation at this point, particularly as more and more devices get connected on the internet through the Internet of Things. But what we can control and what the European Union has begun quite effectively to control is what companies can do with it. So, for example, if we were to go back to the OkCupid dating app, we could pass a law or regulation that says, okay, if you receive information about somebody's sexual habits in a dating profile or their drug use, you can't sell that information to a background investigation company. You can't sell that to a life insurance company or those types of things. So we certainly could have regulations around that data, how long it can be used, what purposes it can be used for.
And in the case of OkCupid, the people who participated on that site, they had no idea their information was being swept by data brokers and being used?
Well, yes and no. This is where it becomes really tricky. So in fairness to OkCupid, they disclosed the fact that they could take all of that data and disclose it to third parties. These are the so-called terms of service that we all see when you try to sign up for an account at Facebook or Google or Amazon or any modern website today when you opt in to play Angry Birds or Candy Crush. All of these come with terms of service. And what's fascinating is almost everybody says, yes, I agree. I have read to and agreed to the terms of service, which in fact is the biggest lie on the internet. Nobody reads these terms of service. A study was done recently that said if every American read the terms of service that they were presented on an annual basis, it would take 78 days of our lives every year just to read them all. And so what we find is that companies write these really uneven, you know, one-sided terms of service to allow them all the rights, and they take away those rights from you, the user. So as one example, Facebook's terms of service when Facebook was first launched many years ago was only 1,000 words. It's now up to 9,600 words. To put that in perspective and see how many words 9,600 words is, the U.S. Constitution is only 4,400 words. Compare it to PayPal, who has the largest terms of service of any company out there. Their terms of service are 36,000 words, whereas Shakespeare's Hamlet was only 32,000 words, and probably a lot more interesting. So I think that a lot of these terms of agreement are actually more like terms of abuse, and we're seeing, unfortunately, that they are being enforced, and people don't understand what they're giving away. If, for example, you read closely Google's terms of service, they've now unified them. So whether you're using, you know, the Google search engine, whether you're using Gmail or Google Docs or Google Voice, you're granting some very significant rights to Google. So Google reserves the right to itself for anything that you put in Gmail or Google Docs. They're reserving the right to publish, republish, dramatize, translate, commercially, you know, use otherwise anything that you put in their system. So the example that I give in this book is if J.K. Rowling had written Harry Potter in Google Docs as opposed to Microsoft Word, she would have, at least according to the terms of service, granted Google control to her $15 billion Harry Potter world.
I couldn't believe that when I read it, to the point where I went back and looked at those terms of service. But would she have no recourse?
Well, I'm sure she's fairly well resourced, so I'm sure now she could go ahead and do it. But for your average Joe or Jane, they certainly don't have the ability to take on Google or Facebook in court, as an example. And so what we're finding is currently case law is quite uneven. Many times they are finding, the courts are finding in the favor of the companies. It's like, look, you went ahead and clicked on this, you agreed to it. But most people don't realize there are terms of service coming with everything now. And I clearly do believe that people are understanding the impact of what it is that they are agreeing to and how much they're giving away.
And what can we do about that? Isn't there a website out there, something like Too Long,
yes,
Didn't Read?
Terms of Service Did Not Read. People can Google that and find it. And they're doing some really fascinating work in trying to lay this out for the public. And I think they even had a documentary along those lines on privacy, which talked about all of this. But I think it's time for the people to at least to understand so that they can make knowing decisions. I want to be clear. I'm not saying Facebook is bad. I'm not saying that Google is bad. They have a business model, and you are buying into it. But given my background in law enforcement and kind of my protect and serve mentality, I like to see that people are not taken advantage of. And it seems to me that the vast majority of people that click on these terms of service have no idea what they're getting into. In fact, there was a company in the UK called GameStop. They're one of the largest online game retailers in the United Kingdom. And just to prove that nobody read their terms of service, on one day for Halloween a few years ago, they added a few lines to their terms of service that said, by clicking here, I agree to irrevocably grant my immortal soul to GameStop for their use. in any way that they see fit. And over 7,500 people clicked on it that day. So people who just bought a game, went through the checkout process, click here to agree to all the terms, actually granted their soul to GameStop in perpetuity.
Incredible. So what's the answer for us going forward as far as terms of service? Because as you said, we would be spending an awful lot of time reading them.
Right. I think there's some really great opportunities for NGOs to get involved in this type of stuff. There are organizations like the Electronic Frontier Foundation, the Center for Democracy and Technology, the ACLU. They all have bits of their organizations that focus on these type of issues. I think there's a lot of opportunity for privacy advocates. We do have people in the U.S. government who are supposed to be advocating on behalf of consumers here, people like the Federal Trade Commission, and they've done some studies around this. But broadly, I think it's just up to the individual consumers. If everybody went ahead and complained when overarching terms of service came out, then you would see the companies react. And we've seen Facebook back down on a couple of occasions, you know, where you will upload a photo and then you're granting perpetual license to Facebook to use your photo. We're now seeing Facebook had, for a period, the ability to use your likeness in an advertisement. So you, you know, if I'm your friend, Facebook would show you my picture with a thumbs up underneath a particular product and say, hey, Mark uses this product, unless they were using my likeness, my photo, to recommend a third-party product to you. And this is all done algorithmically. You know, Brad Pitt gets paid when he endorses products, but you have given up that right. So a lot of Facebook customers complained about that, and Facebook backed down. But frankly, mostly people don't complain. They kind of go along like sheep. And so the companies know that broadly they can get away for it. So it's really up to the people to decide that they don't want this anymore and to fight back.
My guest is Mark Goodman. He's the author of this book, Future Crimes. We've been talking about terms of service and what those terms mean for you. I'm Lori Mack, sitting in for Faith Middleton. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, is your TV eavesdropping on you? Stay with us. I'm Lori Mack, sitting in for Faith Middleton. We've been talking with Mark Goodman. He's an expert on cybercrime, intelligence, and counterterrorism, and has written a book about the flip side of technology. His book is called Future Crimes. So, Mark, we were talking about terms of service, and in relation to that, there are some interesting products on the market that integrate voice recognition, but I think there's a cautionary tale here.
Yeah, so there are actually some tools out there that will allow you to turn on your phone to listen and identify a song or a television station. Well, it's not just the television or the song that they're listening to. They're actually listening to words and conversations and things that you are saying. In fact, we just saw a great example of this with Samsung TVs. Many people today will have smart TVs that have got built-in internet connections so you can stream Netflix and Hulu and other such shows. And Samsung just came out with a new latest generation smart TV, which allowed you not just to use your remote control to control the television station, but actually to speak to your television. So you could say to your TV, TV on, TV off, channel 7, volume up, volume down. It's kind of a cool feature. You don't need the remote control. You just talk to the TV and tell it what you want. But in order for them to do that, Samsung had to update its terms of service, and it said to people, hey, we're going to be listening to everything that you say, and we need to send it to a third party to do voice recognition. So we're going to be listening. We'll take what you say, send it to a third party, and then we will control your TV as you request. But keep in mind, anything that you say in front of your television, we can be listening to. So they literally said, if there's something that you don't wish to discuss that's private, please don't say it in front of your TV. So you can imagine you and your wife or husband, boyfriend, girlfriend are lying in bed having a conversation and your television is listening to it. And it was all disclosed in the terms of service.
I hear some business opportunities out there. You talk in
Absolutely.
The book about how dependent we are on screens, even in crucial service sectors, and the potential vulnerabilities. We're talking about energy, food, agriculture, healthcare, oil, gas, water, transportation, defense, financial services, and on and on. And I'm quoting from the book here. The one thing all of these crucial service sectors have in common is their near total reliance on computer technology and screens as core elements of their safe and secure operation. And a little further down, you say, at nearly every step of the way, the system can be compromised. Wow.
It is a bit of a surprise to realize when you stop and think about it. You know, most people, when they think of hackers or cybercrime, they think about people stealing your information. But there's actually a much more insidious threat. People can change your information. You see, we rely upon computers to give us the answer. If you plug into a GPS device how to get to grandma's house or how to get downtown, you're relying upon those screens to give you the correct information. But those screens can be hacked, and that data can be manipulated and changed in really interesting ways. When you log on to the internet and pull up a stock quote, how do you know what is being shown on your screen is real? In fact, this is how most phishing attacks work. Criminals send you an email. It looks as if it's coming from your bank. You click on it. They take you to a website that looks like your bank, but it's not your bank at all. It's a fake website created by criminals. And these attacks can become quite sophisticated. So they trick you into putting your bank information into their website, the criminal website, because you think you're on Bank America or Citibank, but in fact you're on a criminal website. And probably one of the most famous examples of this was the so-called Stuxnet attack. You may have heard of that. That was an attack, a cyber attack that took place against the Iranian nuclear power site in Natanz inside Iran, and the U.S. and Europe was concerned that Iran was producing a nuclear weapon. Iran said that they were producing, you know, peaceful nuclear power, and one day, a couple of years ago, the power plant got hacked so that the uranium centrifuges, those that were creating the refined uranium required for a nuclear bomb, they stopped functioning. And so they were spinning out of control. But what was fascinating is, as a result of that hack, the screens that the engineers in the control room were looking at all read green, 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 as if all systems were go and everything was fine. And the people that created the Stuxnet Trojan, the Stuxnet virus that carried out this attack, they specifically engineered it so that the screens on the safety systems would falsely report that everything is okay, and in fact, things were not. So we rely upon screens for information, but data can't only be stolen, it can also be manipulated, and that would be a much more insidious threat.
And that hack was accomplished through a thumb drive, I believe. Is that correct?
Yeah, it was alleged that somebody smuggled a thumb drive into the Iranian nuclear power facility because they were smart enough not to keep their nuclear centrifuges online and connected to the internet.
And we've heard a lot about thumb drives and how you should never, if you go to some sort of conference and they're giving them out for free, you should never actually use them.
Throw them away. We know, you know, that's the whole concept of what I call cyber hygiene. We know what hygiene looks like and how to stay healthy in the real world, right? If I go to meet a person and they sneeze, cover their mouth, and then want to shake my hand a moment later, I'm probably not going to be in a big rush to shake their hand. So we know that we're supposed to wash our hands after we sneeze and come out of the restroom and things like that. We have an idea of what to do to prevent disease propagation in the real world, but most people have no idea how to prevent disease propagation in the cyber world, in the digital world. And so, you know, we pass around thumb drives that contain viruses on them. We open up attachments, you know, from strangers that we don't know. We click on links that we shouldn't. And all of those various activities place us at cyber risk. Actually, we can make great strides towards some of these cyber risks by adopting the tools and methodologies of medicine. If you look at how disease propagates in the real world, and those very same tools can be quite useful in combating the cyber threat.
I want to talk a little bit more about your ideas for cyber hygiene. I also want to move to the part of the book, you call it the future of crime, where you talk about Crime Inc. Can you explain what you mean by Crime Inc.?
Sure. So in the old days, crime was a one-on-one affair. A criminal would go out and get a knife or a gun, hide in a dark alley, and then jump out and say, stick them up. They might steal one wallet or two purses, five purses a day doing that. But it was not a business model that scaled. But thanks to the internet, we're all connected around the globe. And so criminals can reach out and touch anybody they want. So, for example, as I mentioned, with the Target hack, we had over 100 million accounts compromised. So we've gone from one person being able to rob one person to one person being able to rob 100 million people. That's never been possible before, and it's all due to our interconnections. And the challenge is that it's making it much, much harder for the police to go out there and do their jobs because the internet broke policing. We used to have a co-location of crime, victim, criminal, and police. Right? It was all located together. So if somebody robbed a bank in downtown New Haven, we would know, okay, this bank, a robbery occurred in New Haven. That means the New Haven police and the FBI have jurisdiction. The criminal was located in New Haven, so we can prosecute him or her. The victim is in New Haven, so the evidence is in New Haven. It was all together. But now through the interconnected nature of the internet, somebody in Moscow or Brasilia can go out there and just as easily rob a bank in New Haven, except that criminal is overseas, the evidence may be overseas, the police that have jurisdiction over the criminal are overseas, and the victim is local. And so the internet broke policing. We no longer have this co-location. And organized crime groups have become increasingly effective at using these tools. We have organized crime groups hiring hackers, and we have organized crime groups that are making their own hackers. Most people, when they think of hackers, they think of the 17-year-old kid and his mom's basement. But according to a study by the RAND Institute, now over 80% of criminal hackers are affiliated with an organized crime group, and the average age of a cyber criminal is 35. So this is 100% a very organized business.
So the internet has broken policing. Hackers that are mostly affiliated with organized crime are committing illegal acts on a much larger scale. Is there something on the horizon that we're looking at in terms of prevention or penalties?
I think that there could be things on the horizon that we should look at, but my concern is that I don't think we are doing it with enough time sensitivity and with enough of a sense of urgency. So right now, if you look at some of, you know, the news, you will see that, for example, people are calling for more focus on cybersecurity and cybercrime, but what they tend to do is put out proposals that say, well, we should increase the penalty for identity theft from 3 years to 6 years. And that just is such a small, minor point. We're never going to get anywhere thinking small, right? It was grand thinking that created the internet as this initial invention going back to the 1960s, and we're going to need grand thinking to work our way out of it. First and foremost, it starts with poor coding. The reason why cyber criminals and others can get into your computer, your work computer, a U.S. government computer, an Iranian nuclear power computer, is because of poor computer code. The code is written in such a way that if you have enough time, energy, and attention, you can find flaws and holes in the code to break in. So I think we need to do a much better job of coding. I think we could also look at liability law, right? If somebody puts out a car that is poorly designed and crashes, then people can sue. Well, where are we with that on the software front? If people put out poor software that causes a power blackout or causes you to be a victim of identity theft, what are your recourses to sue? And it turns out you don't have any because you gave them away in the terms of service that you agreed to. So I'm not a big proponent of regulation. I'm not saying we need a ton of it, but I say when there's gross negligence that can be proven, then that might be an appropriate response. I also think that we need to get the public sector much more involved in this, stronger public-private partnership. Most of the computer technology in our critical infrastructures are not actually run by government, but they're run by third parties, right? It's companies like Con Ed and the like that run the electrical grid. It's personal banks out there that are doing this. The government doesn't have most of that data, so we need to bring together the government and the private sector to have meaningful conversations about this. We're also going to need a lot more help. According to Cisco, we are in 2015 short 1 million cybersecurity professionals around the world. And by 2020, that number will be up to 2 million. We have Reserve Army, Reserve Marine Corps, Air Force, and Navy. We have Reserve and Auxiliary Police Officers. We've got FEMA for national disasters. But we have no National Cybersecurity Reserve Corps at this time. And the fact of the matter is, eventually, we will have that cyber emergency. And that's not the time to train people. I would take 100,000 Americans, people who work at companies big and small, and bring them into the fold so that they can take a part in helping to defend their nation, as we see with these other auxiliary and reserve services. I've called for an XPRIZE for cybersecurity. If you're not familiar with the XPRIZE Foundation, they run these large incentive prizes, and they put up pots of money, $5, $10, $20 million, and try to get input from the general public. Because for all we know, the best answer for the future of cybersecurity may not be in Silicon Valley. It could be in the head of an 8-year-old girl in Chennai, India, or an 80-year-old man in, you know, Freeport, Maine. We just don't know where those better answers are going to come from, and incentive prizes are a great way to go after them. And then lastly, I would say that I think it's time for a Manhattan Project for cybersecurity. When I say Manhattan Project, I don't mean a militarized project necessarily, but let's go back to World War II. At that time, the United States faced an existential threat, the threat of the Nazis getting a nuclear weapon before the Allies did. In response, the U.S. government and its allies brought together public and private sector working around the clock, 120,000 people working 24 hours a day to try to combat the existential threat that the Allies faced to their way of life. If you look at technology and its preponderant role in our lives today, we too face an existential threat, not necessarily from a nuclear explosion, but the loss of all of our critical infrastructures and systems. If the power were to go out, if you happen to be in New York or Connecticut for Hurricane Sandy, we know what that looks like. Imagine that going out for a week or a month. It would have devastating impacts, not just on our personal lives, but on the global economy, national security, and the like. And so we should be thinking big. And so now is the time to assemble a team, public and private sector. It needn't be organized by the government. This can be done by an NGO, a university, but we need to get much, much more intentional. And the good news is, once we do that, we can have a very bright future. Technology is awesome. It's going to help bring billions of people out of poverty. A young man or woman sitting in India or Africa can use a free or nearly free $30 iPad to get access to classes at MIT or Harvard. We're going to radically extend human life, reduce infant mortality. Technology can be awesome, but it's not going to come for free. We're going to have to get more involved. And if we do, I think our future can be amazingly bright.
Those sound like fascinating ideas on the large scale. But I don't want to let you go before we talk about what people can do right now to make themselves less vulnerable to digital threats.
On the personal front, there's a tremendous amount you can do. First, never use a computer, and don't get on the internet. That will make you
right.
Very safe. No, I'm joking. Obviously, those are great tools, and we should be using them. I've actually created a 6-step process that everybody can use to significantly improve their own cyber safety. I've created something called the Update Protocol, UPDATE protocol, that people can use to make themselves safer online. It's based upon research put out by the Australian Ministry of Defense, who studied tens of thousands of cyber attacks and found common vulnerabilities. I put it in terms that people can understand if you think about a car being stolen. If you go ahead and want to protect your car, you're not going to park it in a bad neighborhood with the windows down, with the keys in the ignition, and $10,000 on the dashboard, right? Of course, if you do that, your car will be stolen. But you can also take your car and park it in a great neighborhood, and somebody can come by with a tow truck and take it away. So there's no such thing as perfect security, but there are common sense steps we can take. If you look at how you live your life today, when you leave your house to go to work in the morning, you don't leave your front door wide open. You lock it behind you when you go to work. People need to understand what that looks like in cyberspace, and that's what the Update Protocol does. Just to give you some highlights, it talks about password management, encryption, turning off your computer, user accounts, and the like. And if you follow those 6 steps, you'll reduce your cyber risk by 85%.
Mark Goodman, thank you for being on the show.
Thank you. The pleasure was sincerely mine.
Mark Goodman, author of Future Crimes, Everything is Connected, Everyone is Vulnerable, and What We Can Do About It. You can find a link to Mark's six-step process to cybersecurity, as well as more information on the book and many others by going to wnpr.org/faith. I'm Lori Mack, sitting in for Faith. Thanks for listening.